application of remote sensing in grasslands is not a new concept, but I think what is new is the resolution which we collected data in these experiments and some of these other things that we've done. And some of the stuff I'm going to present was actually part of my master's thesis, and other parts were more or less fishing expeditions that we went on with some of this equipment to see what other things that we could do with remote sensing. You know, depending on what type of data you're getting, for instance, a certain satellite data, you might have 30 meter resolution, you might have 15 meter resolution, and I think just as this fall, Rapid IAG has come out with 5 satellites in geosynchronous orbit that'll allow you to have measurements maybe every day or every other day, and that's at 5.5 meter resolution. So my question is, where are we going to be at 10, 15 years down the road? And I'm going to be talking about it's relatively high resolution data compared to what we have available to us today, and what I think the applications for that data may be in the future if technology gets to this point. But I'm primarily going to be talking about this with respect to the normalized difference vegetation index. You've heard this term 2 or 3 times already today, but the power behind NDVI is that we're looking at that proportion of near-infrared light reflected minus the proportion of red light reflected divided by the sum of those two. And what's nice about this is that it gives us a pretty good estimate of LAI, and if you've looked in the literature, you know LAI is also correlated with biomass. So we do have, this gives us some indication of how much biomass we have in the field. One of the limitations are, and Dennis, you brought this up earlier, and several other people, is talking about that point where we become light saturated. Dennis's data pointed to, his alfalfa was about somewhere between 0.9 and 0.92. What you see in grasses normally tends to be a little lower, somewhere around 0.8 to 0.83, and this is primarily because alfalfa clovers have a planophile leaf, and they're intercepting that radiation much more efficiently than that grass, which has, well, I guess you could call it a rectophile leaf. So that's what I think probably the big differences are in those saturation points. These are some of the potential uses I think we have for this high-resolution reflectance data. All right, I'll define now what I'm talking about as high resolution. I'm talking about things a meter or less. You know, you get into grazing systems and you have patch grazing by cattle, and you know these patches can vary quite a bit. So if you're up in 5.5 meter resolution, which is the best we can do with satellite data right now, that's simply not good enough if you're trying to understand, you know, the grazing strategies of animals. So these are potential uses in pastures. Estimating herbage mass, and that capitalizes on that relationship between LAI and NDVI. The assessment of spatial distribution of herbage biomass, and I'm going to show you some maps later that we've generated of some pastures. Identifying chronically poor areas of growth, and this is, you know, collecting NDVI data throughout the season, throughout the years, and identifying those areas in your field that are probably going to need a little extra attention in order to bring their productivity up. Also, determine the success of establishment. This is some really neat stuff, and this actually touches on what we were talking about a while ago, is how do you handle multiple species. And I think the key to handling multiple species is going to be hyperspectral data, but also increasing the resolution of the data we're collecting. And also identifying weedy areas in the field. And what I'm focusing on here is if you look at the growth of plants during certain parts of the year, your warm seasons are going to brown off in the fall, while your cool seasons still stay green. Certain cool seasons will start to grow and green up faster in the summertime. You know, you have dormancy issues, but all those things can be used to help identify grasses throughout the year, and it's all about the timing and the resolution, and of course green cover, which we've already talked about with LAI. So there, like I say, there are many methods for collecting NDVI data, you know, about satellite data. We're currently right now at ISU, we have John Deere doing flyovers for us, and that's at about 1 meter resolution. And we've been happy with that data. Stuff that I've used in the past and I've been happy with are these active multispectral sensors. And these are two examples. The GreenSeeker RT500, which was an experimental unit built by Antec Industries that was, purchased by a couple of different land grants in the country, but it was made for application of nitrogen. And the one that I worked with Intech Industries on, I really started pushing Intech about a year and a half, 2 years ago. I said, we need something a little more flexible. We need to be able to change the frequency at which data is collected, and we also need a sensor that we can put on the front of a vehicle. Because when you get into fields and you have a tractor weighing down the forage, what happens is you're flattening out that leaf, and what happens is that NDVI value ends up going up. So you get estimates right around that third and sixth sensor that are a little bit off because they're right over that wheel track. Now, the nice things about having an active sensor, and again, I don't think I explained this, an active sensor is emitting its own light and is usually using a backlight filter to get rid of that ambient light. So it's just focusing on the light it emits and the light it collects through the photodiode detector. But the nice thing, it can be used day or night, sunny or cloudy weather. And then another great thing about it, and once you've messed around with aerial photos, you'll understand the benefit of this, is the software actually geo-references that data. I've spent a day or more trying to get pictures just, you know, in the right position, lined up on top of each other, or where the actual points, in order to geo-reference them properly. The disadvantages are the cost. The ATV that you see on the bottom, that RT220, cost about $35,000 if you look at all the equipment involved in that that piece of equipment. The Green Seeker itself, the sensors are about $15,000. And of course, the time takes about an hour, usually takes me about an hour to do between 7 and 10 acres. So another thing that we've been looking at, or we looked at the University of Kentucky, and actually there's a really good poster in one of the sessions, talks about using, you know, just off-the-shelf cameras and taking the filter out of at least one of them, replacing with a clear piece of glass to allow that to focus, and then putting an NIR filter over top of that so you can collect NIR data. The great thing about this is it's extremely cheap. For research purposes, it's extremely cheap. It's about $2,500 for the helichite, and they're extremely tough. You get high resolution data. Some of the data sets that I collected were 12 centimeter resolution. I mean, you can pick out the fence posts in the fields from, you know, aerial photos. And these things can handle winds in excess of 20 miles an hour. I was on the website earlier this week, and they actually had a video of one in 50 miles an hour, or 50 mile per hour wind, and it was stable. Some of the disadvantages are calculating that NDVI can be difficult. And I consider this more or less just a kind of a rough NDVI. We're really not for sure. When you take a picture and break it down in any type of GIS software, you end up with the three bands. So when you download that NIR, or images from that NIR, you still have those three bands, but you're really not for sure where most of that NIR is ending up at. So what we've done is we've taken an average of all three and used that. And for the purposes of just looking at relative differences in the field, it works pretty well. This was a field that had 10 mature thoroughbred mares. And those little dark spots are areas of dung and urine within that field. And you can see that we picked them up, and you had differences in biomass maybe three or four times the grazed area. So there were huge differences in biomass, and we could pick out those spots where they had, you know, where the dung and urine was deposited. Let's go on to the next slide here. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the research that I did at the University of Kentucky and estimating pasture biomass and getting an idea of its spatial distribution. The objectives of this study were to determine if NDVI could be used to assess the spatial variability of herbage mass on grassland landscapes, and also to determine if NDVI could be used to characterize grazing systems. And we kind of piggybacked on a study that Dr. Eric Van Zandt, if any of you all are familiar with him, he has a huge stocker grazing study on endophyte-infected tall fescue. And we chose three of these stocking rates, and again, this is endophyte-infected tall fescue, hence the way we've kind of classified them here. But field one had a low stocking rate at 1,226 kilograms of body weight per hectare. Field two, 1,780, and field three, 2,344 kilograms of body weight per hectare. Now, the particular system we used at the time, this was before we actually got that RT220, was the RT500. And I'll give you just the lowdown on the RT500 here. It has 8 active sensors, and they're approximately 76 centimeters apart. And these sensors would pulse the canopy with red and infrared radiation. It's at 660 and 780. You'll notice today that there's a little bit of a difference in the wavelengths at which people calculate NDVI. And that reflected light was measured with a photodiode detector, and then an onboard computer would take that information, calculate NDVI, and geo-reference it on the go every 76 centimeters. So what you end up with is a 76 centimeter resolution data set within this field. Sampling aggression, in order to calibrate NDVI for predicting biomass, what we did is we took 20 compressed sward surface height measurements along three linear transects in the field. So it was a total of 60 measurements within each of these 3 hectare paddocks. And we used a GPS-enabled rising plate meter, which is what that handsome devil is wearing there in the picture. But each compressed sward surface height point was assigned a series of buffers that range from 0.5 meters up to 4 meters. Now, don't get confused by the idea of a buffer. It's more or less a cookie cutter on top of that NDVI image centered around that compressed sward surface height measurement. So it would actually go in, and within that buffer region would take the average NDVI. Now you're saying that's smoothing data. When you get into submeter accuracies with GPS, sometimes you have to increase that buffer size around there or your data will not marry up properly. So you are smoothing data, but it's almost a have-to thing. If you're using RTK quality data or OmniStar HP, which will give you about 2 or 3 inch accuracy, you can definitely shrink that down quite a bit or not even worry about a buffer at all, just match up points. But again, that average NDVI was calculated within each of those buffers and then regressed against the compressed sward surface height measurement. And we determined from that which one of those buffer size was optimum through the coefficient of determination. I'm sorry, I have the correlation coefficient. It was the coefficient of determination. We also use spatial co-regionalization models to back this up. So the results. The guidelines for the analysis, we had to set some guidelines before we could go through with this study. And one, we measured NDVI and dry matter on the fields at the 56th day of grazing. And what we wanted to assume here in order to do this analysis was that this 56th day of grazing would be the point where we wanted to see how well the animals had utilized forage up to that point. So we didn't want to make any future predictions, or we didn't want to make, you know, guess what the animals had done up to that point, but we wanted to see how well they'd utilized that forage up to that 56th day of grazing. And we set 3 levels of forage availability: inaccessible, which was below 840 kilograms of dry matter per hectare. And this was set by Collins and Daugherty in the new forages textbook. But those are the areas where the animal physically cannot grasp the forage because it's too low to the ground. So we called it inaccessible. Restricted was the 840 to 1680 kilograms of dry matter per hectare. And that was, animals could grasp the forage, but because of the limited bite size, they spent a lot more time grazing in order to make up for that those limited bites. And then the non-restricted was anything over 1,680 kilograms of dry matter per hectare. The animals could graze it. They were optimizing their bite size, and they spent less time grazing. Now, you can put any numbers you want in here, but these are the ones we chose for the sake of this analysis. We'll look at the regression of NDVI against dry matter. It turned out that the 2-meter buffer was the best, and we're going to get into the semivariograms here in a few minutes of this data set, and you can see why these 2 meters kind of worked out the best. But a couple of things I want to point out about this graph. One, it is linear, and the linear model did fit, but a quadratic model fit just a little bit better. But we still decided to go with the linear model for 2 reasons. One, we needed to extrapolate the NDVI value at which we had zero yield. Now, you get into some of these fields that have bare soil and rock, you could have a range of NDVI values on bare soil, maybe from 0.2 up to 0.45 or what have you. We needed to assign a point where NDVI equaled no dry matter or no yield whatsoever. Now, if you're using a quadratic equation, what happens is that quadratic starts to go back up. So those lower NDVI values get overestimated. You know, you get a false yield because of that quadratic equation. Another thing I want to point out is here's that saturation point we were talking about. Notice how noisy that data starts to get when you get above 0.8. You get into those higher LAIs. So the model is significant, and we did see the model was fit to use to estimate dry matter from NDVI. But those are just some of the things that we had to deal with as far as choosing a model and determining the zero or the point where NDVI equaled no yield. Another thing I want to point out is this, the slope of this. Now, NDVI ranges from 0 to 1, so for every 0.1 change in NDVI, we roughly saw 1,000 pounds of dry matter, and that's probably going to differ from field to field depending on what you're looking at, but that was the estimate we kind of came up with there. These are the semibarograms of the data, and I'm really, really excited about the potential of using semibarograms in grazing research. Couple things I want to point out, or if you don't know what a semivariogram is, if you missed some of the talks this morning, the point of the asymptote at which these models, or these semivariograms approach the asymptote, is what's known as the seal, and a lot of times that's known as the total variance within that field. The point where these plots intercept this y-axis is what's referred to the nugget, and a simple way of thinking of the nugget is it can be attributed to the amount of error in your sampling equipment or your sampling procedure. Think of each of these points as a representation of a pair of points separated by a lag, which is corresponding to here on the x-axis. What these are showing you is how closely related points are to each other as you continue to increase the distance between them. So points that are separated here, down here by a half a meter, are a lot more alike than points up here separated by 5 meters. The point at which this curve starts to level off is what, you know, I said earlier is referred to as the seal, but it's also the point where we consider the variability, but just becomes random in the field, and we're beyond what we call the spatial core or the range of spatial correlation. You can see in these fields that the range of spatial core, or the range of spatial dependency, I'm sorry, is somewhere here between 4 and 5. I calculated it. I fit variograms models to these, and it was about 2.5, 3 meters for some of these different pastures. Now, this is where a little bit of theory comes in. That after looking at this data set, we started thinking about how this could be applicable in grasslands. I told you that the seal is the total variance in the field, with that nugget kind of being the amount of error in that piece of sampling equipment that you're using. Imagine a field, if we do a good job of managing our fields before we turn our animals in on it, that field should be relatively uniform. That's what we're striving for. We want to make the field relatively uniform. What should happen is that nugget to seal ratio should be extremely high, because the seal should be closer to the nugget. If that were flat, that's what's called a nugget effect. It'd be like everything in that field would be uniform. You know, not very realistic in grasslands. But the closer that nugget is to the seal, the more uniform that field is. Also, in that same situation, we should also see a greater range of spatial dependency. Instead of seeing around here 2 to 5 meters, we may actually see it out to 10 to 15 meters, depending on, you know, how uniform that pasture is. And my theory is that if you take a pasture and early on you collect the NDVI data, you get those estimates of biomass, and you derive this semivariograms, and you see that high nugget to seal ratio, as animals continue to graze, you should increase the spatial variability, the small scale variability within that field. So what should happen is that range of spatial dependency should start to shift and become smaller and smaller and smaller, because we're creating these patches within the field. Another thing that should happen is we should see that seal increase, and we should see that nugget to seal ratio go down. Now, I believe that statistically, and we need to do the research to back this up, and you know, funding is an issue with this, but statistically we can identify a point where these semivariograms start to shift that we can say something about the way those cattle are grazing. So I think it has a lot of potential in grazing, as far as trying to determine when cattle are changing their grazing strategies, going for more of a patch grazing that, you know, I'm trying to get anything I can wrap my tongue around. So I have a lot of faith in this idea. I'd like to do it, but it may be some time before we can get funding to do something like this. So the histogram analysis. Histograms have been looked at as, you know, identifying, you know, certain things about animal grazing. Dr. Aiken has done work in this, and also there's a Gibb that I'm not familiar with, but I've read a couple of papers where he's looked at that. And trying to identify grazing strategies with animals. But these histograms are derived from 55,000 points within the field. And, okay, I'm like a proud papa. I don't think I've ever seen histograms this nice come out of a grazing study, but we had a lot of data that we collected in each of those fields. But in fields 1 and 2, the low and intermediate stocking rates, what we saw that we had high kurtosis, and kurtosis here, normal kurtosis would be 3. This particular graph has a kurtosis of 4.75. This one here has a kurtosis of 3.5. Now, you can argue that that's really, you know, not that abnormal. But what this is indication of is it indicates low levels of forage utilization within that field. Look at the mean of these two. The mean was 2,693, get my cursor back here, kilograms of dry matter per hectare. And in this field, it was 2,370. Remember those guidelines we said earlier? Anything below 1,680 kilograms of dry matter per hectare, we would consider limiting animal intake. Another thing is the negative skewness. Now, the reason why we have negative skewness is because we have more patch grazing going on. If you want to read more up on that, like I say, there are several papers in the literature that talk about this this negative skewness and how it corresponds to patch grazing in animals. Now, in field 3, we had low kurtosis, as indicated here by a value of 2.75, which indicates that the field was much more heavily utilized. And when you look at that respect to the mean of 1,576 kilograms of dry matter per hectare, now we've fallen below that area that I referred to as restricted. We're below that level. So we also see that now we've shifted from more of a positive skewness, and this is primarily due to the areas of dung and urine patches within that field starting to accumulate because the animals are avoiding them. So the only areas in the field that really have any mass to them or herbage mass to them tend to be those areas located around the dung and urine patches. So looking at these, you could say that fields 1 and 2 were both underutilized at that 56-day grazing mark, and field 3 was slightly overutilized at that 56-day grazing mark. And these are just the maps of the herbage mass within those fields. I get all kinds of arguments about these, but here they are. They kind of show the darker areas are the high yielding areas within the field, and the lighter, once you get into more of this orange color, you're looking at situations where you have little vegetation or no vegetation whatsoever, so you're looking at bare soil. So calculating forage availability, now we're going to take this information and how do we apply it to our management. First of all, we want to calculate the percentage of each field that's above 1,680 kilograms of dry matter per hectare. And here that I've done that, you see the field one has 95% of the area of that field is made up of herbage that's above that 1,680 kilograms of dry matter per hectare. Field two, 86%, and field three, 41%. Then we want to calculate the mean biomass above that 1,680 kilograms of dry matter per hectare mark. And we're going to use that in an equation, which I've referred to as the available non-restricting forage within that field. So we look and we take the percentage above 1,680 times the area, multiplied by the average, well, everything to the right of that area highlighted in that histogram, minus 1,680. And the reason why we're putting it at minus 1,680 is because once we fall below that area, that animal is not going to be able to grasp that forage. And we're going to use that in this equation. And what we see is in field one, there's a total of a little over 3,000 kilograms of dry matter within that field that animal could potentially use before the forage becomes limiting. Now, that's not taking into account dung and urine spots, of course. We're going to have to worry about those. And then field two, we see 2,216 kilograms of dry matter per hectare. Field three, we see 617 kilograms of dry matter per hectare. Now, this is something that you didn't get from the mean because the mean said there was no dry matter in the field available for the animal to eat. This is saying there are some areas. Problem is, it goes right back again to those dung and urine spots within that field. That animal probably will not graze around those. So these animals probably should have come off this field maybe several days prior to this. So the conclusions for this portion. see if I'm doing well on time here. Can NDVI be used to assess the spatial variability of biomass in grassland landscapes? And I think the answer is yes. That when you sample at the resolutions that we sampled at, you can describe the spatial variability within a gray sward and use that to make management decisions. The other thing is, can NDVI be used to characterize grazing systems? And again, I think yes. I think the literature shows this through the use of histograms and looking at things such as skewness, kurtosis, and the things I've added here is the mean yield, and that mean yield above whatever cutoff point that you want to put in there. So these are some of the other potential uses for NDVI and our potentials of high-resolution NDVI data. And this is more or less my fishing expeditions that I did. This is not research. These are kind of ideas that we were trying to get for research projects, and I end up leaving the University of Kentucky for Iowa State sometime after this, and you know, we really didn't get to pursue this. But then now this gets into looking at different species. We took Kindling red clover and we interseeded it into select tall fescue, which is a endophyte-free variety of fescue. And we looked at it in early March before we really started having a lot of growth. And you can see here these darker red areas are corresponding to areas with very, very low NDV or LAI, and these areas that are more yellow are and green are higher yielding areas or areas where we have more green mass. Now what happens by March the 23rd, what we've seen these areas, now they've become very, very dark. And what's happened are these legumes in the field, the red clover in the field, has really started to take off and it has covered the soil faster than the fescue. The fescue is nowhere near becoming light saturated at this point, but the red clover is. So what this allows us to do is kind of to evaluate the red clover establishment or the establishment of a legume in a warm season pasture. And once we kind of establish these areas, then we can maybe break those pastures into management zones or zones where we can go in and say, okay, I know in this area I have red clover growing with fescue, and maybe improve these equations for estimating biomass. Another thing I want to talk about is the identification of these warm season grasses and these cool season pastures, and this has primarily come from the thoroughbred industry in Kentucky. It's a funny situation. Get rid of fescue, but when the fescue came out was killed out, nimbleweed popped up in its place, and now they're more worried about nimbleweed. Even though the animal probably doesn't pay any attention to nimbleweed, they're more worried about getting rid of it for aesthetic purposes. So we used NDVI. I think this was taken maybe in February. And the cool season grasses are green, as you can see here by the darker areas. But your areas of nimbleweed and foxtail do turn up a little more brown. Now, what does this offer us? If you wanted to apply some type of precision ag spraying equipment in this field and use a map like this that was generated early on while those warm season grasses were dormant, then we can possibly go through and spot spray and kill out those areas within the field, reducing the amount of herbicide. And that's really, really important to these guys, is making these fields look good. So that's the potential uses for identifying warm season grasses. And then this is the research right now that I have going on at Iowa State. We're looking at living mulches and corn. And we have 36 different species of grasses and legumes that we're looking at for their suitability for growing with corn, looking for those, you know, that are obviously going to be less competitive with corn. But you can't tell here from the photo, these are running this way within the field, about 10 feet wide, about 400 feet long. And what we're going to do is we're going to come in and put corn in here next fall, using strip tillage equipment and you know, with a planter, and we're going to be evaluating these different forages for how they compete with corn. And the idea is how we want to look at the establishment early on, so we could possibly use that as a covariate when looking at its interaction with corn. But also, how well do these persist after having corn in them ever so often? This is 1 meter resolution data, so what we're getting here is a pretty good indication of cover and how that cover is going to change as these particular species are grown with corn. So I had to fly through that, but I had a lot to talk about. I hope I didn't confuse anyone. But these are some of the references that I have. This is the particular paper that I was talking about that deals with histogram analysis. So with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
We have time for a few questions. Go ahead.
Yes.
I'm being critical, but it seems like from your
DVI and different managers that hire NDVI and hire Herbage when the town has more available mass heat. Wouldn't you be able to take that into DVI?
Yeah, but now we're getting you can get an estimate. I mean, instead of going out the rising plate meter, it may be possible to do this. You know, in Australia right now, there's a Pastures from Space program where they're giving people estimates of herbage increase throughout the growing season. They're making management decisions on this. I think we're eventually going to come to the point where this data can be available to a farmer to make management decisions. So, you know, yeah, you can go out there and look and say the animal hasn't grazed. But looking at a large-scale system, I think this could be very, very beneficial. And I think that looking at the spatial variability of dry matter within the field might be just as important as looking at how much yield you have in that field.
Are you just saying that you can put a number on it?
Yeah, we can put a number on. And this data, if you notice that regression equation, I can tighten that data up on that regression model if I have higher quality RTK or GPS equipment such as an RTK. Because we end up with problems with sampling herbage and the actual location of the NDVI value, and we end up having to kind of smooth that data. You're looking at sub-meter accuracies with the equipment that we're looking at, so you might be mismatching points. And I think we can definitely improve that regression model with the increase in technology. So.
One more quick question before we transition to the next question. I noticed in a number of your maps on alternate passes, the sensors give you different, there's a difference in value.
Yeah, I've had.
We've seen the same thing in your
explanation. Well, there's a couple of explanations for it. One is choosing that pixel size when you're going in to develop that map. Sometimes that can cause streaking. Another thing that can cause that streaking is, like I say, your wheel tracks. Can definitely be a factor in determining those. I checked the sensors in there, and sensors 3 and 6, they did show a little bit of variation compared to the other sensors, but there really wasn't anything to alarm me saying this sensor is off. So things I would look at is I would look at the pixel size that I'm choosing, because a lot of times these pixels will end up overlapping if you choose them to be a little smaller or a little too large, and it looks like it may cause some streaking. So. I would look at that. Other than that, I really don't know, how to put my finger on just exactly what that streaking is. So,
if I could jump in there from my own personal experience working with that same sensor and a couple others, even subtle differences in the angle will translate to pretty substantial differences in reflectance. So you may be going up the hill at a certain angle or a slight grade, maybe it's only 2 to 3% slope, but when you come back the other direction, that especially the way it was set up on that particular tractor, maybe at a slightly different angle. So that could be potentially part of the problem.
So I hope that answers your question, but we think we kind of have an idea what it is.